contract will not be enforced. Therefore, contracts alone cannot overcome the credibility problem. Success can be enhanced by using some additional tools for credibility, such as employing parties with independent interests in enforcement or having a sufficiently strong reputation at stake. In fact, if the reputation effect is strong enough, it may be unnecessary to formalize a contract. This is the sense of a person's word being his bond. A wonderful example of how a strong reputation can obviate the need for a contract comes from the Verdi opera Rigoletto. Gambetta quotes, "Kill the hunchback. What the devil do you mean?" snaps Sparafucile, opera's prototype of the honorable hitman, at the suggestion that he might kill his client Rigoletto. "Am I a thief? Am I a bandit? What client of mine has ever been cheated? This man pays me, and he buys my loyalty." Sparafucile's agreement with Rigoletto did not need to specify, "It is hereby agreed that the party of the first part shall not, under any circumstances, kill the party of the second part." Reputation. If you try a strategic move in a game and then back off, you may lose your reputation for credibility. In a once-in-a-lifetime situation, reputation may be unimportant and therefore of little commitment value. But you typically play several games with different rivals at the same time, or the same rivals at different times. Future rivals will remember your past actions and may hear of your past actions in dealing with others. Therefore, you have an incentive to establish a reputation, and this serves to make your future strategic moves credible. Gambetta, in his study of the Sicilian Mafia, examines how its members can create and maintain a reputation for toughness to lend credibility to their threats. Which devices work and which ones don't? Wearing dark glasses won't work. Anyone can do that. It does not serve to differentiate a truly tough person. A Sicilian accent won't help. In Sicily, almost everyone has a Sicilian accent. And even elsewhere, it is just as likely to be an accident of birth as a mark of toughness. No, says Gambetta, the only thing that actually works is a record of committing acts of toughness, including murder. Ultimately, the test consists of the ability to use violence both at the outset of one's career and later, when an established reputation is under attack from authentic and bogus rivals alike. In most business contexts, we merely talk of cutthroat competition. Mafiosi practice it. Sometimes, a public declaration of your resolve can work by putting your reputation on the line in a public way. During the tense period of the Cold War in the early 1960s, President John F. Kennedy made several speeches to create and uphold just such a public reputation. The process began with his inaugural address. "Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty." During the Berlin crisis in 1961, he explained the importance of the U.S. reputation in terms that illustrate the idea of strategic reputation. "If we do not meet our commitments to Berlin, where will we later stand? If we are not true to our word there, all that we have achieved in collective security, which relies on these words, will mean nothing." And perhaps most famously, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he declared, "Any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere would be regarded as an attack on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response against the Soviet Union." However, if a public official makes such a declaration and then acts contrary to it, his reputation can suffer irreparable damage. In his campaign for the presidency in 1988, George H.W. Bush famously declared, "Read my lips, no new taxes." But economic circumstances compelled him to raise taxes a year later, and this contributed importantly to his defeated bid for re-election in 1992. Cutting off communication. Cutting off communication succeeds as a credible commitment device because it can make an action truly irreversible. An extreme form of this tactic arises in the terms of a last will and testament. Once the party has died, renegotiation is virtually impossible. For example, it took an act of the British Parliament to change Cecil Rhodes' will in order to allow female Rhodes scholars. In general, where there is a will, there is a way to make your strategy credible. One need not die trying to make commitments credible. Irreversibility stands watch at every mailbox. Who has not mailed a letter and then wished to retrieve it? And it works the other way. Who has not received a letter he wishes he hadn't? But you can't send it back and pretend you've never read it once you've opened the letter. In fact, merely signing for a certified delivery letter acts as a proof presumptive that you have read the letter. The movie Dr. Strangelove, which is full of clever and not-so-clever strategic moves, starts out with a good example of the use of irreversibility. The scene is set in the early 1960s, a high point in the Cold War, with serious fears of a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Air Force Strategic Air Command, SAC, had several wings of bombers constantly in the air, ready to fly to their targets in the Soviet Union if and when the command from the president came. In the movie, General Jack D. Ripper, who commanded a base housing SAC aircraft, hijacked a provision, Plan R, whereby a lower echelon commander could order an attack if the president and the rest of the chain of command over him had been knocked out by a preemptive Soviet strike. He ordered a wing of his planes to attack their targets and hoped that the president, presented with this fait accompli, would launch an all-out attack before the inevitable Soviet retaliation was launched. To make his move irreversible, Ripper did several things. He sealed off the base, cut off the staff's communications with the outside world, and impounded all radios on the base so no one would realize that there was no real emergency. He waited to send the go code authorizing the attack until the planes were already at their fail-safe points near the boundaries of Soviet airspace so that they would not need a further authorization to proceed. He kept the only countercommand the pilots were supposed to obey, the recall code, secret. In fact, later in the movie, he killed himself, the ultimate irreversible commitment, rather than risk revealing it under torture. Finally, he sent a phone message to the Pentagon telling them what he had done and was then unavailable for further discussions or questions. An officer read from the transcript of Ripper's message at the resulting meeting at the Pentagon. "They are on their way in, and no one can bring them back. For the sake of our country and our way of life, I suggest you get the rest of SAC in and after them. Otherwise, we will be totally destroyed by Red retaliation. My boys will give you the best kind of start, 1,400 megatons worth, and you sure as hell won't stop them now. So let's get going. There's no other choice. God willing, we will prevail in peace and freedom from fear and in true health through the purity and essence of our natural fluids. God bless you all." The officer incredulously concludes, "Then he hung up." Ripper's hanging up was meant to be the final act that made his move irreversible. Even the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States, would not be able to reach him and order him to recall his attack. But Ripper's attempt to achieve a U.S. commitment did not work. The president did not follow his advice. He instead ordered a nearby army unit to attack Ripper's base, which they did successfully and quickly. The president contacted the Soviet premier and even gave the Soviets details about the attacking planes so they could shoot them down. The base was not perfectly sealed. An exchange program British officer, Lionel Mandrake, discovered a working radio playing music and later a payphone and a Coke machine to supply coins to phone the Pentagon. Most importantly, Ripper's obsessive doodling enabled Mandrake to guess the recall code. However, one plane, commanded by a Texan captain with a lot of initiative, got through. All of this conveys an important practical lesson in strategy. Theory often makes it sound as if the various moves being discussed are either 100% effective or not at all. Reality is almost always somewhere in between. So do the best you can with your strategic thinking, but don't be surprised if something unexpected, an unknown unknown, as former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld would say, nullifies your efforts. There is a serious difficulty with the use of cutting off communication as a device to maintain commitment. If you are incommunicado, it may be difficult, if not impossible, to make sure that the rival has acceded to your wishes. You must hire others to ensure that your stipulation is being honored. For example, wills are carried out by trustees, not the deceased. A parental rule against teenage smoking may be exempt from debate while the parents are away, but also unenforceable. Burning bridges behind you. Armies often achieve commitment by denying themselves an opportunity to retreat. Although Xenophon did not literally burn his bridges behind him, he did write about the advantages of fighting with one's back against a gully. Sun Tzu recognized the reverse strategy, namely the advantage of leaving an opponent an escape route to reduce his resolve to fight. The Trojans, however, got it all backward when the Greeks arrived in Troy to rescue Helen. The Trojans tried to burn the Greek ships. They did not succeed, but if they had succeeded, that would simply have made the Greeks all the more determined opponents. The strategy of burning bridges, or boats, was used by several others. William the Conqueror's army, invading England in 1066, burned its own ships, thus making an unconditional commitment to fight rather than retreat. Hernan Cortes followed the same strategy in his conquest of Mexico, giving orders upon arrival that all but one of his ships be burned or disabled. Although his soldiers were vastly outnumbered, they had no choice but to fight and win. Had Cortes failed, it might well seem an act of madness, yet it was the fruit of deliberate calculation. There was no alternative in his mind but to succeed or perish. The strategy of burning one's ship plays out in The Hunt for Red October, where Russian Captain Marco Ramius plans to defect and bring the latest Soviet submarine technology to the United States. Although his officers are loyal, he wants them to have no doubt about their new course. After revealing his plan to them, Ramius explains that just prior to departure, he mailed a letter to Admiral Yuri Pedorin, detailing his intention to defect. Now the Russians will try to sink the sub. There is no turning back. Their only hope is to reach New York Harbor. In the world of business, this strategy applies to attacks on land as well as by sea. For many years, Edwin Land's Polaroid Corporation purposefully refused to diversify out of the instant photography business. With all its chips in instant photography, it was committed to fight against any intruder in the market. On April 20th, 1976, after 28 years of a Polaroid monopoly on the instant photography market, Eastman Kodak entered the fray. It announced a new instant film and camera. Polaroid responded aggressively, suing Kodak for patent infringement. Edwin Land, founder and chairman, was prepared to defend his turf. "This is our very soul we are involved with. This is our whole life. For them, it's just another field. We will stay in our lot and protect that lot." On October 12, 1990, Polaroid was awarded a $909.4 million judgment against Kodak, which was forced to withdraw its instant film and camera from the market. Sometimes, building rather than burning bridges can serve as a credible source of commitment. In the December 1989 reform in Eastern Europe, building bridges meant knocking down walls. Responding to massive protests and emigration, East Germany's leader, Egon Krenz, wanted to promise reform but didn't have a specific package. The population was skeptical. Why should they believe that his vague promise of reform would be genuine and far-reaching? Even if Krenz was truly in favor of reform, he might fall out of power. Dismantling parts of the Berlin Wall helped the East German government make a credible commitment to reform without having to detail all the specifics. By reopening a bridge to the West, the government forced itself to reform or risk an exodus. Since people would still be able to leave in the future, the promise of reform was both credible and worth waiting for. Reunification was to be less than a year away. leaving the outcome beyond your control or to chance. Returning to Dr. Strangelove, President Merkin Muffley invites the Soviet ambassador into the Pentagon War Room to let him see the situation with his own eyes and be convinced that this was not a general U.S. attack on his country. The ambassador explains that even if just one plane succeeded, it would set off the doomsday machine, a large number of buried nuclear devices that would pollute the atmosphere and destroy all human and animal life on Earth. The president asks, "Is the Soviet premier threatening to explode this device?" The ambassador replies, "No, sir. It is not anything a sane man would do. The doomsday machine is designed to trigger itself automatically. It is designed to explode if any attempt is ever made to untrigger it." The president asks his nuclear expert, Dr. Strangelove, how this was possible, and is told, "It is not only possible, it is essential. That is the whole idea of this machine, you know. Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack. And so, because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process, which rules out human meddling, the doomsday machine is terrifying." It's simple to understand and completely credible and convincing. The device is such a good deterrent because it makes aggression tantamount to suicide. Faced with an American attack, Soviet Premier Dmitry Kissov might refrain from retaliating and risking mutually assured destruction. As long as the Soviet Premier has the freedom not to respond, the Americans might risk an attack. With the doomsday device in place, the Soviet response is automatic and the deterrent threat is credible. In the real Cold War, the real-life Soviet Premier Khrushchev attempted to use a similar strategy, threatening that Soviet rockets would fly automatically in the event of armed conflict in Berlin. However, this strategic advantage does not come without a cost. There might be a small accident or unauthorized attack, after which the Soviets would not want to carry out their dire threat, but have no choice, as execution is out of their control. This is exactly what happened in Dr. Strangelove. To reduce the consequences of errors, you want a threat that is just strong enough to deter the rival. What do you do if the action is indivisible, as a nuclear explosion surely is? You can make that threat milder by creating a risk, but not a certainty, that the dreadful event will occur. This is where brinkmanship comes in. The device that creates a risk of mutual disaster in brinkmanship is just as automatic as the doomsday machine. If the opponent defies you, you no longer control whether to explode the device. But the automatic explosion is not a certainty. It is only a probability. This is just like Russian roulette. One bullet is loaded into a revolver. The chamber is spun and the trigger pulled. The shooter no longer controls whether the firing chamber contains the bullet, but he controls the size of the risk beforehand, 1 in 6. Thus, brinkmanship is a controlled loss of control. The threatener controls the size of the risk, but not the outcome. If he finds an empty chamber and decides to pull the trigger again, he is raising the risk to 1 in 5, just as Bud White did in L.A. Confidential. How far he chooses to do this depends on his tolerance for the risk. All the time, he is hoping that the opponent has a lower tolerance for risk and will give in, and that the mutually undesirable explosion will not occur before either concedes. No wonder brinkmanship is such a delicate strategy, fraught with dangers. Practice it at your own peril. We recommend trying it out in relatively innocuous situations before you try it on a really important occasion. Try to control the behavior of your kids, where the bad outcome is merely a messy room or a tantrum, before you try to play negotiation roulette with your spouse, where the bad outcome may be a messy divorce or a court fight. Moving in steps. Although two parties may not trust each other when the stakes are large, if the problem of commitment can be reduced to a small enough scale, then the issue of credibility will resolve itself. The threat or promise is broken up into many pieces, and each one is solved separately. Honor among thieves may be restored if they have to trust each other only a little bit at a time. Consider the difference between making a single $1 million payment to another person for a kilogram of cocaine and engaging in 1,000 sequential transactions with this other party, with each transaction limited to $1,000 worth of cocaine. While it might be worthwhile to double-cross your partner for $1 million, the gain of $1,000 is too small, since it brings a premature end to a profitable ongoing relationship. Whenever a large degree of commitment is infeasible, one should make do with a small amount and reuse it frequently. This is also true for homeowners and contractors who are mutually suspicious. The homeowner is afraid of paying up front and finding incomplete or shoddy work. The contractors are afraid that after they have completed the job, the homeowner may refuse to pay. So at the end of each day or each week, contractors are paid on the basis of their progress. At most, each side risks losing one day's or one week's worth of work or money. As with brinkmanship, moving in small steps reduces the size of the threat or promise and correspondingly the scale of commitment. There is just one feature to watch out for. Those who understand strategic thinking will reason forward and look backward, and they will worry about the last step. If you expect to be cheated on the last round, you should break off the relationship one round earlier. But then the penultimate round will become the final round, and so you will not have escaped the problem. To avoid the unraveling of trust, there should be no clear final step. As long as there remains a chance of continued business, it will never be worthwhile to cheat. So when a store has a going-out-of-business sale with massive price reductions, be especially cautious about the quality of what you are buying. Teamwork. Often, others can help us achieve credible commitment. Although people may be weak on their own, they can build resolve by forming a group. The successful use of peer pressure to achieve commitment has been made famous by Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, and diet centers. The AA approach changes the payoffs if you break your word. It sets up a social institution in which pride and self-respect are lost when commitments are broken. Sometimes teamwork goes far beyond social pressure and employs strong-arm tactics to force us to keep true to our promises. Consider the problem for the front line of an advancing army. If everyone else charges forward, one soldier who hangs back ever so slightly will increase his chance of survival without significantly lowering the probability that the attack will be successful. If every soldier thought the same way, however, the attack would become a retreat. Of course, it doesn't happen that way. A soldier is conditioned through honor to his country, loyalty to fellow soldiers, and belief in the million-dollar wound, an injury that is serious enough to send him home out of action, but not so serious that he won't fully recover. Those soldiers who lack the will and the courage to follow orders can be motivated by penalties for desertion. If the punishment for desertion is certain and ignominious death, the alternative, advancing forward, becomes much more attractive. Of course, soldiers are not interested in killing their fellow countrymen, even deserters. How can soldiers who have difficulty committing to attack the enemy make a credible commitment to kill their countrymen for desertion? The ancient Roman army made falling behind in an attack a capital offense. As the army advanced in a line, any soldier who saw the one next to him falling behind was ordered to kill the deserter immediately. To make this order credible, failing to kill a deserter was also a capital offense. Even though a soldier would rather get on with the battle than go back after a deserter, failing to do so could cost him his own life. The motive for punishing deserters is made even stronger if the deserter is able to gain clemency by killing those in line next to him who failed to punish him. Thus, if a soldier fails to kill a deserter, there are now two people who can punish him, his neighbor and the deserter, who could save his own life by punishing those who failed to punish him. The tactics of the Roman army live on today in the honor code enforced at West Point, Princeton, and other universities. Exams are not monitored, and cheating is an offense that leads to expulsion. But because students are not inclined to rat on their classmates, failure to report observed cheating is also a violation of the honor code and leads to expulsion as well. When the honor code is violated, students report crimes because they do not want to become guilty accomplices by their silence. Similarly, criminal law provides penalties for those who fail to report a crime as an accessory after the fact. Mandated negotiating agents. If a worker says he cannot accept any wage increase less than 5%, why should the employer believe that he will not subsequently back down and accept 4%? Money on the table induces people to try negotiating one more time. The worker's situation can be improved if he has someone else negotiate for him. When the union leader is the negotiator, his position may be less flexible. He may be forced to keep his promise or lose support from his electorate. The union leader may secure a restrictive mandate from his members or put his prestige on the line by declaring his inflexible position in public. In effect, the labor leader becomes a mandated negotiating agent. His authority to act as a negotiator is based on his position. In some cases, he simply does not have the authority to compromise. The workers, not the leader, must ratify the contract. In other cases, compromise by the leader would result in his removal. The device of using mandated negotiating agents becomes especially useful if you are negotiating with someone with whom you share other bonds of friendship or social links that you are reluctant to break. In such situations, you may find it difficult to adhere firmly to negotiating positions and may concede more than you should for the sake of the relationship. An impersonal agent is better able to avoid falling into this trap and can get you a better deal. Members of professional sports teams employ agents partly for this reason, as do authors in their dealings with editors and publishers. In practice, we are concerned with the means as well as the ends of achieving commitment. If the labor leader voluntarily commits his own prestige to a certain position, should you, do you, treat his loss of face as you would if it were externally imposed? Someone who tries to stop a train by tying himself to the railroad tracks may get less sympathy than someone else who has been tied there against his will. A second type of mandated negotiating agent is a machine. Very few people haggle with vending machines over the price. Even fewer do so successfully. That is why many store clerks and government bureaucrats are required to follow rules mechanically. The store or the government makes its policy credible. Even the employees benefit by being able to say that negotiating or bending the rule is above their grade. Undermining your opponent's credibility. If you stand to gain by making your strategic moves credibly, then similarly, you will benefit by preventing other players from making their strategic moves credible, right? No, not so fast. This thinking is the relic of the idea that games must be win, lose, or zero sum, an idea that we have consistently criticized. Many games can be win-win, or positive sum. In such games, if another player's strategic move can achieve an outcome that is better for both, then you benefit by enhancing the credibility of such a move. For example, in a prisoner's dilemma, if the other player is in a position to make you a promise to reciprocate your choice of cooperation, then you should try to enable him to make that promise credibly. Even a threat, deployed mutually, may be in the combined interests of the players. In the previous chapter, we saw how our two catalog merchants, Rainbow's End and BB Lean, can use meet the competition or beat the competition clauses to make threats of retaliation against a rival's price cut. When they both use such a strategy, each removes the temptation for the other firm to make a price cut in the first place and thereby helps both firms keep their prices high. Each firm should want the other to have the ability to make its strategy credible, and if one of them thinks of the device, it should suggest to the other that both should use it. That said, there are many situations where the other player's strategic move can hurt you. The other player's threats do often work against your interests, so make some commitments. In such circumstances, you want to try to prevent the other from making that move credible. Here are a few suggestions for practicing that art. Once again, we give them with the caution that they are tricky and even risky, and you should not expect perfect success. Contracts. Mr. Rousseau, in our story, had two selves. One before chocolate eclairs appear on the dessert trolley, BCE, and the other after, ACE. The BCE self sets up the contract to defeat ACE's temptation, but the ACE self can render the contract ineffective by proposing a renegotiation that will benefit all the parties that are present at that point. The BCE self would have refused ACE's proposal, but BCE is no longer there. If all the distinct parties to the original contract are still present, then to get around a contract, you have to propose a new deal that will be in the interests of everyone at that point. Gaining unanimous consent is difficult, but not impossible. Suppose you are playing a repeated prisoner's dilemma game. An explicit or implicit contract says that everyone should cooperate until someone cheats. After that, cooperation will break down and everyone will choose the selfish action. You can try to get away with cheating once by pleading that it was just an innocent error and that all the available gains from future cooperation should not be wasted just because the contract says so. You cannot hope to pull this trick too often, and even the first time others may be suspicious, but it does seem like children get away with "it won't happen again" time after time. Reputation. You are a student trying to get a deadline extension from your professor. He wants to maintain his reputation and tells you, "If I do this for you, I will have to do the same for everyone in the future." You can come back with, "No one will ever know. It is not in my interest to tell them. If they write better assignments by getting extensions, my grade will suffer because the course is graded on a curve." Similarly, if you are a retailer, negotiating a lower price with your supplier, you can credibly promise not to reveal this to your rival retailers. A reputation is valuable only to the extent that it gets publicized. You can make it ineffective by maintaining secrecy. Communication. Cutting off communication may protect the player making a strategic move by making his action irreversible. But if the other player is unavailable to receive the information about the opponent's commitment or threat in the first place, the strategic move is pointless. A parent's threat, "If you don't stop crying, you won't get dessert tonight," is ineffective against a child who is crying too loudly to hear it. Burning bridges. Recall the advice of Sun Tzu. When you surround an enemy, leave an outlet free. One leaves an outlet free not so that the enemy may actually escape, but so that the enemy may believe there is a road to safety. If the enemy does not see an escape outlet, he will fight with the courage of desperation. Sun Tzu aimed to deny the enemy an opportunity to make his own very credible commitment of fighting to the death. Moving in steps. The credibility of mutual promises can be enhanced by breaking large actions into a sequence of small ones. But you can try to destroy the credibility of an opponent's threat by going against his wishes in small steps. Each step should be so small in relation to the threatened costly action that it is not in the interest of the other to invoke it. As previously discussed, this method is called salami tactics. You diffuse the threat one slice at a time. The best example comes from shelling. Salami tactics, we can be sure, were invented by a child. Tell a child not to go in the water, and he'll sit on the bank and submerge his bare feet. He is not yet in the water. Acquiesce, and he'll stand up. No more of him is in the water than before. Think it over, and he'll start wading, not going any deeper. Take a moment to decide whether this is different, and he'll go a little deeper, arguing that since he goes back and forth, it all averages out. Pretty soon, we are calling to him not to swim out of sight, wondering whatever happened to all our discipline. Smaller nations understand this, just as small children do. They defy the wishes of superpowers in little ways, vote independently in the United Nations, violate some clauses of trade agreements, and even take successively tiny steps toward acquiring nuclear technology, that are too small to invoke serious retaliation. Mandated agents. If the other player aims to achieve credibility for an inflexible negotiating position by using a mandated agent, you might simply refuse to deal with the agent and demand to speak directly to the principal. A channel of communication must be opened between those two. After all, the agent has to report the outcome to the principal. Whether the principal agrees to deal directly with you then depends on his reputation or other aspects of his resolve. As an example, suppose you are attempting to negotiate the price of an item in a department store and the clerk tells you that he has no authority to offer a discount. You can ask to see the manager, who may have such authority. Whether you attempt this depends on your judgment about the likelihood of success, on how badly you want the item, and on your valuation of the humiliation if you fail and have to settle for the listed price. This completes our array of illustrative examples of devices for making your own strategic moves credible and for dealing with other players' strategic moves. In practice, any particular situation may require more than one of these devices, and even in combination, they may not work 100% of the time. Remember, nothing is perfect. And Billy Wilder would have us believe nobody's perfect. We hope our little guide serves to engage your interest and gives you a starting point for developing these skills in the games you play. Case study, a textbook example of credibility. The size of the U.S. college textbook market is $7 billion, including course packets. To put that in perspective, the revenue from the movie industry is about $10 billion, and all of professional sports is $16 billion. Textbooks may not have Heisman trophies or Academy Awards, but it is a big business all the same. Perhaps that might not be so surprising when you consider that textbooks routinely cost more than $150. That's about the price for Samuelson and Nordhaus's Economics 18th edition, or Thomas's Calculus 11th edition. And students might buy 8 or so a year. Congress has proposed a way out. It wants college bookstores to guarantee that they will buy back the used texts. At first glance, this might seem to cut the student's cost in half. If you can sell a $150 book back at the end of the semester for $75, then the real cost is cut in half. Is that right? Case discussion. Let's take a step back and look at the world from the publisher's perspective. If a typical textbook will be resold twice on the used market, then the publisher gets to make only one sale rather than three. If they were looking to make $30 profit per student, now they have to make $90 on the first sale to come out even. This is what leads publishers to raise the list price of the text all the way up to $150, which allows them to get their $90 profit up front. And once the books are sold, they have every incentive to eliminate competition from the stock of used textbooks by coming out with a new edition as quickly as they can. Compare this to a world where the publisher promises not to bring out a revision and the students promise not to resell their used books. Over 3 years, the publisher could sell three books at $50 each and make the same amount of money. Actually, that ignores the extra printing costs, not to mention the environmental cost of the trees cut down. So we'll bump the price up to $60. In this world, the publishers are just as happy, professors spend less time making unnecessary revisions, and students get a better deal. They buy the book for $60 and get to keep it as a reference rather than paying $150 and hoping to resell it for $75, for a net price of $75. There's one group of students who fare really badly under the present system, the ones who buy a new text in the final year of an edition. A new edition will be assigned for the following year, so they can't sell their used copy back to the store. These unlikely students end up paying the full $150. Students aren't dumb. They don't want to be left holding a hot potato. After a text has been on the market for 2 or 3 years, they realize that a revision is due. Students anticipate that the effective cost of the book is going to be much higher and so they respond by not buying the text. As faculty, we were surprised to learn that somewhere around 20% of students don't buy the required texts. Eliminating the used textbook market would be an improvement for students, faculty, and publishers. The losers would be the bookstores. They make more money from the status quo. On the $150 text that is resold twice, the store makes $30 on the original sale, and then $37.50, twice more each time they buy it back for half price and resell it at three quarters of list. They'd make much less selling a new book three times for $60 each. Forcing the bookstores to buy back used texts doesn't solve the problem. It would only lead them to pay less, as they would anticipate getting stuck with all obsolete texts. Better than forcing the store to buy back the texts is having students promise not to resell and thereby eliminating the used market. But how can that promise be credible? Banning used book sales isn't practical. One answer is to have students lease or rent the textbooks. Students could put down a deposit on the book that is refunded when they return the book to the publisher, not the bookstore. This is just like having the publishers promise to buy back the text whether there is a new edition or not. Even simpler, publishers could sell licenses to the text, just like a software license, to each student in the class. This would give each student access to a copy of the text. The university would pay for the license and bill the students. Now that the publisher is making all of its profits via the license, the books can be sold for a price near production cost, and so there is little motivation to resell the books. In general, when there is a problem of commitment, one way around the issue is to rent rather than sell the product. That way, no one has an incentive to take advantage of the used book stockpile because there isn't any. There are two more cases on making strategies credible. See, But One Life to Lay Down for Your Country and United States versus Alcoa in Chapter 14. Epilogue to Part 2, A Nobel History. Game theory was pioneered by John von Neumann. In the early years, the emphasis was on games of pure conflict, zero-sum games. Other games were considered in a cooperative form, that is, the participants were able to choose and implement their actions jointly. For most games played in reality, people choose actions separately, but their effects on others are not ones of pure conflict. The breakthrough that allowed us to study general games combining conflict and cooperation is due to John Nash. We explained his concept of what is now known as Nash equilibrium in Chapter 4. In our presentation of the equilibrium concept, we assumed that all the people in the game understood the preferences of the other players. They might not know what the other players would do, but they understood each other's objectives. John Harsanyi, who shared the 1994 Nobel Prize with Nash, showed that Nash equilibrium could be extended to games where players are unsure about the other player's preferences. Another challenge in the application of Nash equilibrium is the potential for multiple solutions. The work of 2005 Nobel laureate Robert Aumann shows that this challenge becomes even greater in repeated games. Almost anything can be a Nash equilibrium in a game that is repeated often enough. Fortunately, there are some tools that help us select one equilibrium over another. Reinhard Selten demonstrated that the Nash equilibrium concept could be refined, thereby eliminating some of the multiplicity by introducing the idea there is a small possibility that a player will make a mistake when moving. This forces players to ensure that their strategy is optimal even when the game takes an unexpected turn. It turns out that this is much like the idea of look forward, reason backward, but applied to games where people move simultaneously. When we recognize that players in a game may not have perfect information, it becomes important, even essential, to specify who knows what. I might know that you prefer one outcome over another, or that you are lying to me, but if you don't know that I know that, then that changes the game. Another of Robert Allman's contributions was bringing the concept of common knowledge to game theory. When two players have common knowledge of something, not only do they both know it, but they each know that the other knows it, knows that the other side knows they know it, and so on to infinity. Lack of common knowledge is the more common case. One or more of the players in these games lacks some crucial piece of information that the other has. The better informed player may want to conceal or distort the information, or sometimes may want to convey the truth to a skeptical adversary. The less informed player generally wants to find the truth. This makes the true game between them one of manipulating information. Concealing, revealing, and interpreting information each require their own special strategies. During the last 30 years, the ideas and theories of information manipulation have revolutionized economics and game theory and have had a huge impact on other social sciences and on evolutionary biology. We've discussed the contributions of 2005 laureate Thomas Schelling, who developed the ideas of commitment and strategic moves. Three other Nobel Prizes in economics have honored pioneers of these theories and their applications, and there are probably more to come. The very first, given in 1996, honored James Mirrlees and William Vickrey, who developed theories of how to design a game that will achieve truthful revelation of the other player's private information. The Economist succinctly characterized their contribution as answering the question, how do you deal with someone who knows more than you do? Mirrlees did this in the context of designing an income tax system when the government does not know people's income-producing potential, and Vickrey analyzed strategies for selling by auction. In 2001, the Nobel Prize went to George Akerlof, whose model of the private used car market illustrated how markets can fail when one party has private information. Michael Spence, who developed the signaling and screening strategies that are used for coping with such information asymmetries, and Joseph Stiglitz, who developed the application of these ideas to insurance, credit, labor, and many other kinds of markets, yielding some startling insights on the limitation of markets. The 2007 prize was also for information economics. Screening is just one strategy available to gain information about others. More generally, a player, often called the principal, can devise a contract that creates incentives for the other players to reveal their information directly or indirectly. For example, when A cares what B does, but can't monitor B's actions directly, then A can devise an incentive payment that induces B to take an action closer to what A desires. We take up the topic of incentive schemes in Chapter 13. The general theory of the design of such mechanisms was developed during the 1970s and 1980s. The 2007 Nobel Prize honored three of the most eminent pioneers of this research: Leonid Hurwitz, Eric Maskin, and Roger Meyerson. Hurwitz, at 90, became the oldest recipient ever of the Economics Nobel Prize. Maskin, at 56, and Meyerson, at 57, were among the youngest ever. Information economics and game theory are truly for all ages. We will present many of these Nobel ideas in the next chapters. You will learn about Akerlof's market for lemons, about Spence's job market signaling, the Vickrey auction, and Meyerson's revenue equivalent theorem. You will learn how to bid in an auction, run an election, and design an incentive scheme. One of the wonderful aspects of game theory is that it is possible to understand the contributions of Nobel laureates without having to spend years in graduate school. Indeed, some of the ideas may even seem obvious. We think that is true, but only in hindsight, and that is the mark of a truly brilliant insight. Part 3. Chapter 8. Interpreting and Manipulating Information. The Marrying Kind? True story. Our friend, whom we'll call Sue, was in love. Her beau was an extremely successful executive. He was smart, single, and straight. He professed his love to her. It was a happily ever after fairy tale. Well, almost. The problem was that at age 37, Sue wanted to get married and have kids. He was on board with the plan, except that his kids from a previous marriage weren't ready for him to remarry. These things take time, he explained. Sue was willing to wait, so long as she knew that there would be a light at the end of the tunnel. How could she know whether his words were sincere or not? Unfortunately, any public demonstration was out of bounds, as the kids would surely find out. What she wanted was a credible signal. This is the cousin of a commitment device. In the previous chapter, we emphasized strategies that guaranteed that the person would carry out what he said he'd do. Here, we are looking for something weaker. What Sue wanted was something that would help her understand whether he was truly serious about their relationship. After much thought, Sue asked him to get a tattoo with her name. A small, discreet tattoo would be just fine. No one else would ever have to see it. If he was in this for the long run, then having Sue's name indelibly inked would be a fitting tribute to their love. But if commitment wasn't part of his plan, this would be an embarrassing artifact for his next conquest to discover. He balked. So Sue left. She found a new love and is now happily married with kids. As for her ex, he is still on the runway, on permanent ground delay. Tell it like it is? Why can't we just rely on others to tell the truth? The answer is obvious, because it might be against their interests. Much of the time, people's interests and communications are aligned. When you order a steak medium rare, the waiter can safely assume that you really want the steak medium rare. The waiter is trying to please you, and so you do best by telling the truth. Things get a bit trickier when you ask for a recommended entree or advice on wine. Now the waiter might want to steer you to a more expensive item and thereby increase the likely tip. The British scientist and novelist C.P. Snow attributes just such strategic insight to the mathematician G.H. Hardy. If the Archbishop of Canterbury says he believes in God, that's all in the way of business, but if he says he doesn't, one can take it he means what he says. Similarly, when the waiter points you to the less expensive flank steak or bargain Chilean wine, you have every reason to believe him. The waiter might also be right when recommending the expensive entree, but it is harder to know. The greater the conflict, the less the message can be trusted. Recall the soccer penalty kicker and the goalie from Chapter 5. Suppose that, just as he is getting ready to take his shot, the kicker says, "I'm going right." Should the goalie believe him? Of course not. Their interests are totally opposed, and the kicker stands to lose by making his intentions known truthfully in advance. But does this mean that the goalie should assume that the kicker will kick to the left? Again, no. The kicker might be trying a second-level deception, lying by telling the truth. The only rational reaction to an assertion made by another player whose interests are totally opposed to yours is to ignore it completely. Don't assume it to be true, but don't assume its opposite to be true either. Instead, think about the equilibrium of the actual game, ignoring what the other side has said, and play accordingly. Later in this chapter, we explain just how to do this using the example of bluffing in poker. Politicians, advertisers, and children are all players in their own strategic games with their own interests and incentives. And what they are telling us serves their own agendas. How should you interpret information that comes from such sources? And conversely, how can you make your claims credible, knowing that others will regard what you say with due suspicion? We start our exploration with perhaps the most famous example of divining the truth from interested parties. King Solomon's Dilemma. Two women came before King Solomon, disputing who was the true mother of a child. The Bible takes up the story in 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 24 through 28. Then the king said, "Bring me a sword." So they brought a sword for the king. He then gave an order, cut the living child in two, and give half to one and half to the other. The woman whose son was alive was filled with compassion for her son, and said to the king, "Please, my lord, give her the living baby. Don't kill him." But the other said, "Neither I nor you shall have him. Cut him in two." Then the king gave his ruling, "Give the living baby to the first woman. Do not kill him. She is his mother." When all Israel heard the verdict the king had given, they held the king in awe, because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice. Alas, strategic experts cannot leave a good story alone. Would the king's device have worked if the second woman, the false claimant, had understood what was going on? No. The second woman made a strategic blunder. It was her answer in favor of dividing the child that distinguished her from the true mother. She should have simply repeated whatever the first woman said. With both women saying the same thing, the king would not have been able to say which one was the true mother. The king was more lucky than wise. His strategy worked only because of the second woman's error. As for what Solomon should have done, we offer that as a case study in chapter 14. Devices for manipulating information. The kinds of problems faced by Sue and Solomon arise in most strategic interactions. Some players know more than others about something that affects the payoffs for them all. Some who possess extra information are keen to conceal it, like the false claimant. Others are equally keen to reveal the truth, like the true mother. Players with less information, like King Solomon, typically want to elicit it truthfully from those who know. Pretending wisdom greater than that of Solomon, game theorists have examined several devices that serve these purposes. In this chapter, we will illustrate and explain them in simple terms. The general principle governing all such situations is, actions, including tattoos, speak louder than words. Players should watch what another player does, not what he or she says. And knowing that the others will interpret actions in this way, each player should in turn try to manipulate actions for their information content. Such games of manipulating behavior to manipulate others' inferences and seeing through others' manipulation of our inferences go on every day in all of our lives. To borrow and twist a line from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, you must constantly prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. If you do not recognize that your face, or more generally, your actions, are being interpreted in this way, you are likely to behave in a way that works to your own disadvantage, often quite seriously so. Therefore, the lessons of this chapter are among the most important you will learn in all of game theory. Strategic game players who possess any special information will try to conceal it if they will be hurt when other players find out the truth. And they will take actions that, when appropriately interpreted, reveal information that works favorably for them. They know that their actions, like their faces, leak information. They choose actions that promote favorable leakage. Such strategies are called signaling. They will act in ways that reduce or eliminate unfavorable leakage. This is signal jamming. It typically consists of mimicking something that is appropriate under different circumstances than the ones at hand. If you want to elicit information from someone else, you should set up a situation where that person would find it optimal to take one action if the information was of one kind, and another action if it was of another kind. Action, or inaction, then reveals the information. This strategy is called screening. For example, Sue's request for a tattoo was her screening test. We will now illustrate and explain the working of these devices. In Chapter 1, we argued that poker players should conceal the true strength of their hand by bidding somewhat unpredictably. But the optimal mix of bids is different for hands of different strengths. Therefore, limited information about the probability of a strong hand can be derived from the bids. The same principle holds when someone is trying to convey rather than conceal information. Actions speak louder than words. To be an effective signal, an action should be incapable of being mimicked by a rational liar. It must be unprofitable when the truth differs from what you want to convey. Your personal characteristics, ability, preferences, intentions, constitute the most important information that you have and others lack.